Dr. Richard Jackson is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell is with me. We are at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, the National Center for Environmental Health. You were talking about population of humans. This is sort of an abstraction for a lot of us, but when you say, okay, in my lifetime, or that baby we saw in the elevator, when she's an adult, that the whole physical environment in which we live will have been dramatically impacted, changed. How do you pull these pieces apart as you look at environmental health? Not only where do you begin, but is there a place that's the most important place, or is everything most important? Back to that Gordian knot.
You know, in environment, we spend a lot of time thinking about water resources and air quality and other kinds of environments. And yes, they're enormously important. And yet, when you think about air, we spend 95% of our time indoors. And so how we design our homes, how we ventilate our homes, heat them, how we light them, is it natural lighting, the efficiency of our homes, do they waste energy? That's really a health issue at the same time. What are the materials we are bringing into the home? Are they loaded with packaging? And are we wasting resources that our great-grandchildren may well need as we throw away excess and useless packaging? So where we live, the built environment, and what we consume, these are health issues. And it's easy to think, oh, you know, recycling, that's not a health issue. But ultimately, it does become a health issue. In fact, I would like to change the name of my center. Right now it's called the National Center for Environmental Health, and people think, oh, you must work for the EPA or you must be doing environment. I want to change it to Environmental Public Health, because in public health, we, you know, a good doctor looks at the health of the entire individual, and a good public healther needs to be looking at the health of the entire population. And sometimes, actually, as public healthers, we do things that aren't terrific for single individuals. For example, when we quarantine people and we're keeping them out of social networks because they may be carrying a disease, that's not great for that individual, but it is essential for the population at large. And public health has a long tradition of worrying about population groups. Sometimes I say I do wholesale health instead of retail health.
It's the notion of public health, looking at all the variety of things that you touch, and more broadly the CDC, it seems almost that is the quintessential public function, the function of government, that's the, you know, sort of underlie, it's what makes it possible to have a community, to sustain a community, from a minimal standpoint, you know, just, you know, life for, before liberty and life, liberty, and
pursuit of happiness.
Pursuit of happiness. The liberty piece, you know, may figure in differently, but the pursuit of happiness. The what you were talking about earlier, the not only being not sick, but being healthy. It seems that what you do goes to the heart of what we want from and expect from governmental entities.
What we ultimately want from government, the two big things we want from government, one is protection and safety from threats. And of course, that's why we raise armies, and that's why we work to protect ourselves in one way or another. And one can debate exactly how one goes about that. But the other kind of protection is from, you know, microbial threats, from disease threats, from chemicals we produce that we thought were perfectly harmless that turned out to be miserable. I'll give you an example. We knew that lead was toxic to the developing brain. We knew this back, the pediatricians knew it back in the 1910s, 1920s. And yet society went ahead, put lead in gasoline, lead in paint, lead in food cans, and lead in many other sources. By the time I was a little boy, my blood lead was 22, 23, 24. 10 to 12 kids a year were dying in our big cities of lead poisoning from paint in the homes and other sources. And the average blood lead in the United States was a blood lead of 20.
Which should be less.
And we thought that, everyone thought that was perfectly fine.
It was normal.
That was normal at that time. Well, over time, we've gotten rid of lead and gasoline. And people said, oh, it's going to be the end of the world, the end of the automotive industry, the end of the gasoline industry. And of course, we're all doing pretty well. We got rid of lead and paint, and our homes haven't fallen down, and we still have nice paint to put on our homes. The average blood lead of a two-year-old today, average blood lead of an American, is a blood lead of 2. Not 20, but 2. Let me tell you some things that happened. One is we discovered that a lead of 20 is pretty toxic, and in fact, someone at 20 is running about 5 IQ points less than someone with a blood lead of 2. That person,
so the direct and tangible consequences.
Right. That person with the higher lead level has much higher rates of hypertension, kidney disease, shorter lifespan. There's a whole string of bad things that happen from lead. And yet we made decisions as a society three generations ago that have had impacts for a long, long time. And we need to be much more thoughtful about this. I actually did some calculations looking at the economic benefit of the fact that our new generation isn't polluted. Their brains aren't polluted with lead. And each child having 5 to 6 more IQ points, that calculates out in the hundreds of thousands of dollars in lifetime income for every child, and an additional $200 billion every year that that cohort of kids that are born that year will earn in their lifetime by being more creative, more energetic, more ability to attend to tasks and do well in school.
You raise what sounds like a public policy issue. Back when you were talking about when we were growing up, it was acceptable, public policy, both overtly and de facto, said this is okay. And yet we still have, I mean, you're still dealing with some of those policy issues. There are still noxious chemicals in the environment. We still pump things into the environment that, as I read the materials that you publish and look at your website, a lot of those are destructive.
CDC.gov.
But a lot of that goes to the public will, not so much government, but how the public feels about it. And when I say public policy, I'm on small p, public policy. But it would seem that part of your challenge is education, is informing people about what the trade-offs are in these kinds of things.
One of the things I've been most impressed about in my career in public service in the area of environmental public health is that much of the leadership around the things that we've dealt with, whether it's air pollution or smog or water. You know, water quality in our country is much better than it was 25 years ago, thank goodness. We're now getting fish swimming back up the Hudson. It wouldn't have been there, and rivers don't catch fire in Cleveland. So we have made genuine progress. There's still plenty to do. It's still a political decision that has to be made about what's going to happen. The point I was going to make about the thing that surprised me is when you look, most of the leadership has not come from scientists. It's not come from doctors. It's not come even from political leaders. It has come from the public themselves. And I think one of the most important tools, especially in a democracy, in dealing with the environment is something we call right to know. And that there is an absolute need, and I think in the era of the internet, we have the tools to provide the public with information. About 5-8 years ago, 10 years ago when I was working in California, there was a move to require that water companies, drinking water companies, supply information as to the chemical content and pollution content of the water being served to the customers. And surprise, surprise, there were huge arguments that this would frighten people or that people weren't smart enough to deal with this. And what did we find? That the companies very quickly did what they could to get those levels so low that they could issue a report that said, our water is great. It's as good as anything you'd buy in a bottle. And so that right to know has created political will. And if you go to a country that's coming out of despotism or tyranny, in the environmental arena, the one thing they want more than anything else is information. In some of the totalitarian countries, the level of chemical in the water or the chemical pollution of the air was considered a state secret that people did not have a right to.
There are so many important things about which to talk. You talk at one point about using the notions that ecology, the science of ecology, have offered us about scaling things, being able to look at the very smallest and the very biggest. And whether you're talking about people coming out of a totalitarian circumstance or whether you're just talking about people who live in a community and some mom gets upset about her kid, this business of being able to look at the big issues from small places and the small issues from big places that empower individuals to do things in a time when people sometimes just say, well, I can't do anything. I'm here and you say, oh, yeah, we can. And whether it's a little thing or a big thing, that getting people actively involved in issues may be as important as anything else that one can do to get the light the fire.
I feel very strongly that the leadership has got to go two ways. It absolutely has to be bottom-up. People have to be talking about their concerns and participating in the public process. And, you know, in the era of email, you can let your political leaders know what you want them to know. At the same time, I've been in government long enough to know that top-down is also very important. I saw under the president's initiative around children's health and the environment, where the president and the members of the cabinet held the agencies accountable. Every 6 months, we had to go in and say, here's what we are doing about these big children's environmental health challenges. One of the challenges was lead poisoning. And it was one thing for the health, you know, health agencies like CDC to say, we'll deal with lead poisoning. It was another thing when the Department of Justice, the Department of Housing, the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy all had to stand there and say, okay, this is our contribution as well. In areas of developmental disabilities, children not developing adequately, it was one thing for education, Department of Education, to say something, but to have all the agencies say, okay, we have a part in this too. So top-down leadership is also very important, and it's easy for people to become cynical about the political process, but sooner or later we get the government we deserve.
Well, and part of it, I think this came from John Keegan talking about some of the challenges we're facing. Both leadership seems to be very important, but also followership. And, mm-hmm. and as Americans, and I think we're not unique, but we may have carried it further than others, there's a tendency to want to go on our own direction, set our own priorities. I mean, we're in a sort of an extreme version of the freedoms we have, but it would seem that part of the challenge is to understand what the public will is, as well as to provide the information that people need to make decisions. And I would also think that getting people to care enough to attend to that information is also part of the equation.
And we'll let you decide if it's part of the equation or not when we come back in just a moment with Dr. Richard Jackson, who is the director of the National Center for Environmental Health, the name of which we will change one day perhaps, at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, known as the CDC, in Atlanta. Please be with us on the Paula Gordon Show when we come back in just a moment.